Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of December 1st. I'm very happy to have with us this week Father John Deere. Welcome, Father.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Now, Father Deere is the author of the new book, A Persistent Peace, One Man's Struggle for a Nonviolent World, which is published by Loyola Press. And maybe we start by just giving some details about your life. 1978, 30 years ago, you're a student at Duke. As you describe yourself, a spoiled frat boy. You wanted to be a rock musician, maybe follow your father into the publishing industry. 30 years later, you're a controversial Jesuit. You've been arrested more than 70 times. What happened in the last 30 years?
I'm still trying to figure it out. That's why I wrote my book. But, you know, just for the record, please just call me John, I always say, because my name is so goofy. Father Deere doesn't work. You know, I don't get any respect. It's been a long, strange trip, to quote a rock star. I was at Duke, and I tell it in some detail in my autobiography, and decided to leave the church, gone to a Jesuit high school, and was quite appalled. Went to a good Methodist school, Duke. Then decided I wasn't going to believe in God. And long story short, I decided, oh gosh, of course I believe in God. I have to give my whole life to God, and you have to love and serve everyone. My next thought was, oh my God, I'm going to have to enter the Jesuits. And then I decided, like St. Ignatius and Francis and Dominic, to go on a holy pilgrimage to see where Jesus lived. And just my luck, in that summer of 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon. And he ended up walking through the war zone and seeing the reality of war. And actually at the Sea of Galilee, while I was reading the Gospel of Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount, I saw jets swoop down and bomb and kill a lot of people at the place where Jesus said, love your enemies. And changed my life. I always joke that my plan was to be a pious Jesuit, you know, which is probably an oxymoron. But the job description is to live the Sermon on the Mount, to love our enemies, to be blessed peacemakers, to hunger and thirst for justice. And I've been trying to do that ever since, and it's taken me around the world. It's taken me organizing demonstrations, taken me meeting with leaders and religious leaders, and doing everything I can to work for the abolition of war itself, and poverty, and nuclear weapons, and global warming. And here I am, still trying to follow the nonviolent Jesus and trying to figure out what it means to be a peacemaker in a world of war.
Now, as part of your work, you've written more than 20 books on peace and nonviolence, but this is the first book where you've told your own story. What did you learn about yourself and your faith from writing this book?
Well, I always thought, I've had a lot of adventures. You could call them adventures in gospel peacemaking. I'm trying to be positive here. And I met everybody. I feel like I've met millions of people and been everywhere in the world. And I thought, oh, well, there was one great moment. Or was there, do we have a conversion experience like St. Paul? That's the turning point. And I just described, too, at Duke, being converted to believe in God. And then I kind of had a second call, a call within a call, or a vocation within a vocation, to live and practice the Sermon on the Mount, which I now think is what everybody's vocation is. But then I realized in writing the book that I was wrong, that it's not about any particular turning point or religious experience per se. I've come to the conclusion that the journey's the thing, that we're called to follow Jesus and to stay faithful to the journey, come what may, and to do what we can as his disciples, which means, I submit, walking the road to peace. Or to paraphrase chapter 7 of the Sermon on the Mount, the narrow path of nonviolence and life. So, you know, to stay the course. And I came to that conclusion writing this autobiography of Persistent Peace. And what I like most now about Mahatma Gandhi and Dorothy Day and Martin Luther King, and imagine the Berrigans or Thomas Merton, all our heroes, our saints, that we can whine at the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, Thich Nhat Hanh, Tutu. They stayed faithful to the course, to the gospel work of peace and justice, even though most of the great people did not see great achievements. The world is getting much worse. But to continue to do what you can for peace and justice and to speak out and practice nonviolence. And that's what I'm learning and what I want to do with the rest of my life. I invite people to reflect on their own lives, as I have, to see their life journey from their childhood up to today as a movement, if Gandhi might say, from violence to nonviolence. How have you moved, you know, from violence of your youth and childhood to being part of, complicit in the culture of war, to choosing to walk a road to peace, to becoming more and more nonviolent? and to say, for the rest of my life, I want to walk that road and be faithful to following the nonviolent Jesus. I find that a beautiful way to look at the spiritual life and what the church is called to do in the world, to be the community of peacemakers, faithful to the God of peace, come what may.
Now, as you say, you've traveled the world and met all sorts of leaders in this movement, but a lot of your energies have been focused in this country. And in this book you write about, you know, early on when you were deciding, you know, where are you going to focus your efforts, you decided that this country needed a lot of attention. Why here and not in, say, another country with much more perhaps obvious issues?
Well, you know, the big question in Jesuit circles theoretically is discernment. It all comes down, if it's all goods, where does the God of peace want you on your short time on earth? What does Jesus particularly call each of us to do to help make the world a more nonviolent, peaceable, just place? So I got involved early on with Daniel Berrigan, my hero and teacher, and saw his work to end war and nuclear weapons, and thus to end poverty. But I just was sick of the United States. And in 1985, you know, I moved to El Salvador and worked under the tutelage of the great Jesuits who were assassinated 19 years ago. Met with them at the UCA. This was 1985, at the heart of the war. They sent me out to work in a refugee camp that was being bombed by the United States. The theory was when the death squads came in to kill or to kidnap the poor, they'd send me out, young white gringo Jesuit, and maybe they'd kill me, hopefully, or they wouldn't kill them because I was there. It was a really powerful experience, and I was going to stay. But the Jesuits who were killed said to me, we need you to go back and to stop your country from killing us and the poor of the world. And they said, your job is going to be harder. They're going to kill us and do everything they can to stop us, but they're just going to ignore you. And yet, you are the only ones who can do what we can't. You are the ones who know the United States, and you have to give your life trying to stop your government from killing the poor around the world. And that made a powerful impact upon me. And so I see the United States now as moving into full-scale empire, regardless of the new president, that we're involved in 30 wars, often selling weapons to both sides. We're still making nuclear weapons. At Los Alamos, near where I live, New Mexico, the United States government is now building a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. And the world is rushing toward global warming and unprecedented poverty, 900 million people starving to death today, our country leading the way in this. And so all of us in the United States have to stand up, especially as church people, as Christians, who dare to claim to follow the nonviolent Jesus, be people who love our enemies, and to resist the empire, and to help stop our government from bringing death as a methodology to so many people around the planet. And I think, you know, it's almost easier in some way to go off to a refugee camp. I'm considering going to work with JRS in Africa, and I'm at the moment considering an invitation to go to Iran. But the work is here, and U.S. Catholics in the United States need to stand up and help convert the Catholic Church into a prophetic voice for disarmament and justice, and help the church become the community of nonviolence, and that withdraws all our participation in the culture of war, in the Pentagon, in building nuclear weapons, and really, really helps to start saving lives around the world.
Now, 15 years ago, as part of your efforts in pursuit of peace and against war, you sneaked down to the Air Force base in North Carolina and pounded on a F-15 bomber with a hammer in protest of nuclear arms. And as a result, you got more than 6 months in prison. And as you write about, the experience took a real toll on you, both physically and emotionally. Is this something you think about? Do you think about taking another action like that that could virtually guarantee more time in prison?
What a question. Do you? No. You know, that was just where God had called me. And as I said to the judge, hey, Your Honor, I'm just doing what the Bible said. The holy prophet Isaiah said, someday people are going to come along and beat their swords into plowshares, and the world will never study war again. And Jesus gave us this famous commandment, love your enemies, don't nuke them. I always say that's what the actual Greek translation is. That didn't go over well with the judge. But mine was about the 50th of now about 80 plowshares actions around the world. And it was a very small symbolic act. Actually, I just hammered once or twice on this big thing, and I didn't even chip the paint. You know? We were just symbolically saying, this is the future. We will dismantle our weapons of mass destruction, and we will use those monies to feed the starving masses of the planet. You know, Thomas Aquinas said, property is that which is proper to human life. Should gas chambers exist? Cremation ovens? Nuclear weapons? No. The Ukraine and South Africa have unilaterally dismantled their weapons of mass destruction, and we will one day. But for that act, I faced 20 years in prison and was found guilty of two, the most serious felony charges you can get, destruction of government property and conspiracy to commit a felony crime. My life was changed forever. I can never vote again. I can't travel to a lot of countries. I'm highly monitored by the government, you know, in airports. And when I travel the world, you know, it doesn't say, oh, he's a Jesuit priest working for peace and all. It says, get him. So I live with it all the time. And I know a lot about prison and court. And it's funny, I always joke, I think I wrote in my book, you know, nobody takes me seriously. The Jesuits don't take me seriously. The church doesn't take me seriously. The media doesn't take me seriously. My family doesn't take me seriously. But the government takes me very seriously because they understand that if you have church people and grandparents and students and ordinary people practicing the nonviolence of Jesus, walking on a military basis and saying, that's it, we're not going to put up with killing our sisters and brothers in the planet, we're going to begin the process of disarmament, they have a problem. They got to nip it in the bud because they understand nonviolence better than we do. Nonviolence is contagious. So, you know, I've been arrested many, many times since then, and I'm just coming off a very strict federal probation. I could have just been in prison most of this year for a very harmless witness we did in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We were just going to petition the office of the senator asking him to not support the evil war in Iraq. And we 9 of us got in the elevator and they arrested us. But they were really after me because I'm trying to work on a campaign to close Los Alamos in New Mexico. I don't want to go to prison. I don't like prison. It's horrible. I don't want to get killed. I hate getting hate mail and death threats. I don't like being denounced by priests and bishops. But the guy I follow was executed. This is the job description for the Christian. You know, I'm a member of the Society of Jesus. He said, if you want to follow me, take up your cross and walk, as the cross has nonviolent resistance to empire. And he turned over the tables in the temple where the religious authorities are working with the empire to oppress all the people and steal all the money. And he said, I'm not going to tolerate injustice. We're called to be people of contemplative peace. If you're doing civil disobedience in the temple on the outskirts of an evil empire, you're going to be arrested and tortured and killed. That's a no-brainer, and that's what happened. What would he say about what we're doing in Iraq, about our 20,000 nuclear weapons, about our treatment of the earth? And what are followers of this guy supposed to be doing today? We all have to figure out some way or other to resist the empire. Now, I'm not saying everybody has to do a plowshares action. I'm not even saying everybody has to commit nonviolent civil disobedience. But I do insist that if every Christian has to do something for peace and justice. I love what Oscar Romero said at the sermon in a minute before he was assassinated. Nobody can do everything, but everyone has to do something. Everyone has to be part of the global movement now for the disarmament of the world. And that's what I'm discerning right now. What am I going to do? What's my next step? The main thing is to follow the nonviolent Jesus and to be part of welcoming God's reign. And now it's maybe the most critical moment in history to be part of Jesus's campaign for peace.
Well, that leads to another good question. You mentioned, you know, maybe not everyone is called to follow the life that you have chosen, but what can the average Catholic do to work towards peace?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks. And then my autobiography is I'm sharing my story, and I did that as a gift to invite other people to reflect on their story and their journey, especially in light of this Gandhian hermeneutic of nonviolence, or how would you put it, the gospel call to make peace. Well, I think you got to ask God that question, first of all. In your daily prayer, take time with the God of peace. Look at the violence within your heart. Let it go. Allow God to disarm your heart. Give it to Jesus. Let Jesus give you his resurrection gift of peace. Try to become a person of inner nonviolence. I want to plumb the mystical depths of peace, to know the God that we worship as a God of peace, to know the risen Jesus as a peacemaking person who gives us this gift of peace. We have to really work in our personal and interpersonal nonviolence. And Catholics are not so good at that. We're all pretty violent people, and so that's a very important challenge. But then I think everybody's got to be a part of a peace and justice group, I personally believe. You can't do any of this alone. So I think every Catholic in the United States should join Pax Christi. That's the official arm of the Roman Catholic Church for Peace and Justice. It has a complete support of the Vatican. When I met Pope John Paul II with a group of Pax Christi people, he practically cried, telling us he wished every Catholic was a member of Pax Christi. It's the full support of the cardinals and the bishops. A lot of the U.S. bishops don't like it because they are Republicans who support war. They actively support war. But I'm saying that's a very easy thing to do. But certainly your parish, you can join your local Peace and Justice Committee. You've got to study peace and justice, learn from the great peacemakers. Somehow or other, pick one or two causes, not everything, one or two causes that are dear to your heart. Ending the war in Iraq, working to end hunger, stopping the death penalty, working to end racism or sexism, whatever it is. And get involved and like tithe your time to be part of the global grassroots movement. Me, I'm working to close Los Alamos, and we have an annual campaign, an annual vigil at Los Alamos on every August 1st. And people are invited to come to that. They can check our website, PaxChristiNewMexico.org, or you can look at my website, JohnDeere.org. Just pick one cause and get involved, and to see it as part of your spiritual life, your journey.
Now, let me just follow up quickly. You mentioned some of the bishops and their attitude toward war. And as most of our listeners will know, the bishops did, for example, condemn the war in Iraq. So maybe you can just elaborate on that and what your feeling is about their stance on war.
Well, they were late to do it as far as I'm concerned. I wish they had been blasting our government to stop this war like the Pope had been, you know. Well, the main contribution of the bishops was the pastoral letter on peace in the early 1980s, which said, you know, okay, as a Catholic, you can espouse the just war theory and or nonviolence. That's a legitimate Christian Catholic position in the church. That was what the early church did. I hope that the bishops will stand up vocally and condemn the U.S. participation in all wars, because they'll say that to be a Catholic is to be a follower of Jesus who said, love your enemies. He didn't say, if they're really bad, though, and they follow they meet these seven conditions, bomb the hell out of them. Jesus never said that. That has nothing to do with the gospel. So that the bishops will do what the Pope has been hinting at, which is that the just war theory no longer applies. Benedict has said that. And the day is coming when we're going to get rid of it. He said that about a year before he became Pope. And I think that's the future, and I would like to see the bishops teaching Catholics the imperative of working for peace and justice, even teaching the nonviolence of Jesus, upholding the seamless garment, the consistent ethic of nonviolence that says you just can't pick one or two issues, abortion, for example. You have to be against violence in all its forms. It's the only way it makes sense, as Cardinal Bernardine said. Abortion, yeah, but war, nuclear weapons, poverty, racism, sexism, global warming, any form of violence is to be condemned. We are people of nonviolence in every aspect of life. The bishops have to lead us in that. They have to model it in their own lives, and they have to help the church to throw the just war theory out finally once and for all and let us return to the Sermon on the Mount. That's my hope.
Now, you mentioned the just war theory. The idea behind perhaps throwing it out, as you say, is that in this age where nuclear weapons are available, there is just virtually no way to wage a just war?
Well, I don't even understand it. You know, it says, I suppose, you can't. One of the conditions is you can't kill non-combatants. Well, war changed over the last century. At the beginning of the century, 10% of the victims of war were civilians. Now it's 90%. So if you're dropping a bomb at 35,000 feet over Baghdad, you're going to kill all the civilians in the marketplace, and that's what we've killed. Some stories say we've killed 1.2 million Iraqi civilians since March 2003. That violates the just war theory. But we're having preemptive strike. We're planning nuclear weapons that can destroy the whole planet, all of creation. So this is way beyond the conditions of the just war. But what I'm saying is, yeah, Merton wrote about this clearly, and so many other scholars have now, that the conditions can't be met. But I'm saying, what would Jesus have us do? And what does it mean in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, love your enemies? And what's so shocking to me is he doesn't say, love your enemies because it's the moral thing to do or the right thing to do or the only practical political solution, which I think you could argue that it is. That's the way Martin Luther King talked. Jesus says you love your enemies because you are sons and daughters of God who loves universally, the Son on the good and the bad, the rain and the just and the unjust. This is the most perfect description of the nature of the mystery of God in this revolutionary political teaching. Love your enemies because that's the way God is. Wow! That changes everything. He's saying God is a God of nonviolence and universal love. So if you want to identify yourself as a son or a daughter of God, and that's what we all have to do, grow up and become mature Christians and say without false humility, yes, I am the beloved of God. That's what Henry Nouwen, my friend, was trying to teach us. Well, then you have nothing to do with war, because every human being on the planet is your sister and brother, and you're going to practice this universal love, and you're going to give your life to stop the killing and the roots of war, which is poverty and disease, and you're going to end nuclear weapons and so forth and so on. So we're talking about changing everything, this moment that we're in, changing the direction of the church and helping to abolish war forever. And the church has a critical role to play that if the future is going to be a future of peace, and it has to be. I could go on and on, Tim. Sorry about this.
No.
We're probably way off your question.
Now, part of your campaign against war and for peace, you've been a critic of America, and in particular, the magazine's decision to accept ads, the military were advertising for chaplains. Now, we just published a special issue on this topic because we always get letters about it, and one of the contributors, Father John McLean, a fellow Jesuit, who was a chaplain, he argued that even in a time of unjust war, soldiers need spiritual resources that really only a chaplain can provide. What is your position?
The only spiritual guidance we should be giving to soldiers is to quit the military to save their lives and not to kill anybody. So at the minute a chaplain would start to do that, he would be fired by the military. But I think it's a bogus argument because so many chaplains end up with machine guns. I've heard some priests were in Fallujah. Certainly many were in Vietnam. And I've seen that around the world. But, you know, we misunderstood how we're being bought off and co-opted by the Pentagon to just go ahead and not criticize the war or try to stop the wars and try to stop the war machine, which is the role, I'm arguing, of the Christian. So I don't think any priest should have anything to do with the military. No one should be wearing a weapon of any military in the world or the U.S. military. No one should be part of it, getting money from it. No priest should be carrying a weapon or have anything to do with blessing weapons or killing. And that the role of the priest or the pastor is the model, the good shepherd. And Jesus, the way I see that, is the good shepherd protects the flock from the forces of death, from the fox, whom he called Herod. He's trying to lead the pasture into pastures of peace, no more death. So we're not involved in killing one single person anywhere in the world. We would never allow that to happen, and too often that does. It just doesn't work. After the last century, wars are getting so much worse. So many people are dying. We need the church to lead the way in ending war, getting people to quit the military, dismantling our weapons, closing the Pentagon, beating swords into plowshares, studying war no more, and loving our enemies. So I invite all those who are priests who are interested in doing that to join all the various peace groups who go into the war zones and side with civilians, as I have done. When I led a delegation of Nobel Prize winners into Iraq, we met 10,000 civilians. And to listen and be with them, you can minister them, and you can also talk to people in the military. I talk to people in the military all the time, thousands of people, and people in the government, from Los Alamos to the Pentagon to government officials. So there's good works to do you can do, but you don't have to be part of the military machine, and I think we're being used. In particular, I would ask America Magazine no longer to take a penny from the Pentagon for any ads, no matter how noble they may appear. And to take a position that, you know, we're just not going to support the war machine anymore. You don't have to come out against war. At least just don't take money for them. That would be my position. What does Jesus want us to do? That's my final argument. And I argue that Jesus would not have 1 ounce of participation in the system of empire.
Well, again, we take up this question in our November 17th issue, and we look at both sides, and we have a short editorial explaining our policy, which you can look at. Now, perhaps we can end by talking about the larger issue of, you know, you've spent your life and you want to spend your entire life pursuing nonviolence. But as you said, you know, you're trying to resist an empire. You're a minority fighting in this battle. And one of your mentors, Father Dan Barragan, obviously another very prominent Jesuit peace activist, has said that it's best not to get entangled in concerns for results or success in pursuing nonviolence, but better instead to do good and seek the truth, and let them bear fruit in their own time. reading your autobiography, you're obviously very action-oriented. You come from a high-achieving family. How do you avoid getting overly concerned with the concrete results of your work?
Wow, what a question. That's very deep, profound stuff. And I studied Gandhi in his particular branch of Hinduism. He writes about, it's a line from the Bhagavad Gita, about being an inner detachment from the fruit of the results of your action. Wow, I don't even know what that means. It means you give your life, he's saying, for the independence of India and the abolition of poverty, but you're detached that you're going to do it. So then Thomas Merton writes to Jim Forrest in this famous letter in the 1960s at the height of the Vietnam War. Look, do not depend on the hope for results, he said. Place your hope in God, and the results are in God's hand. So you give your life for God's, the coming of God's reign. We're not building it. I hate that phrase. We're welcoming God's reign of nonviolence. God's reign has nothing to do with war, greed, poverty, racism, sexism, nuclear weapons, global war. God's reign is a reign of nonviolence. And we want to actually kind of be part of institutionalizing that. And so teaching nonviolence around the world and ending all these wars. But it's God's work, not ours. So you give your life for this, proclaiming God's reign and the political and social and economic implications of it, and leaving the outcome, the results in God's hand. So how do you do that? This is going back to the basic stuff. Daily prayer, spending time every day with the God of peace, allowing God to disarm us of the violence within us, because we're all part of the system, we're all sinners, we're all violent people. And wow, I found that God is really actively interested in disarming our hearts and then sending us out as God's instruments of God's disarmament of the world. Then we have something really to offer. And then to be part of God's movement for nonviolent change and disarmament. So your question is how to do that. You just work at it. You know, it's a very fine gospel line. I don't claim to be doing this. I claim to be a violent person trying to practice nonviolence. I made a lot of mistakes. But as I said at the beginning, I want to be faithful. And I see that's what the saints and mystics are doing. And this is where it's at. Man, this is the best, the good stuff in the world. All the greatest religious leaders in the last century, from Gandhi and Dr. King to Mother Teresa and Archbishop Tutu and Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama, they're all talking about a world of nonviolence. This is the heart of the spiritual life. This is the work of God. So you pray about it, you talk about it with friends, and you do what you can, and you keep reflecting, you try to be nonviolent, working as hard as we can to end this evil war in Iraq, to end nuclear weapons and poverty and global warming. And yet we're at the same time just trying to be faithful to the nonviolent Jesus, seeing that this is God's work. So we're going to try to be very peaceful and prayerful and nonviolent and be detached somehow from the results so that our lives bear good fruit. That's the gospel word compared to the Pentagon word about effectiveness, success, efficiency, results. Those are not biblical words. Those are American words. Those are Wall Street words and Pentagon and Los Alamos words. We're not like that. We're slow, patient, peaceful peacemakers, and our lives are going to bear good fruit in the long haul that will change the world, as Jesus did, as Francis did, as Gandhi and Dorothy Day have done, and that's what we're called to do. We're all called just to be faithful, and that's what I'm trying to do and why I wrote my book.
Well, the book, again, is A Persistent Peace, One Man's Struggle for a Nonviolent World. And you can learn more about John Deere at his website, www.persistentpeace.com. And with that, we want to thank John Deere for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Thank you again for joining us for the America Magazine podcast. I wanted to note that John Deere's personal webpage is johndeere.org. Persistentpeace.com is the website for his book. You can also keep up to date on his writings at NCR Cafe, where he writes a weekly column. Finally, I want to thank Stephen Martin, a contributor to America, for coming up with some of the questions that we discussed. If you're interested in responding to our conversation with John Deere, you can go to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.